Tracy Tully, and you're listening to Tracy Tully Talks at bbsradio.com, the place to be right now, streaming live with another 60 minutes of thought-provoking topics, sharing with you conversations that are relevant today, tomorrow, and in the future. Join me each week on Thursday mornings at 10 a.m. Australian time, AEST, 5 p.m. Wednesday PT, hello Los Angeles. If you missed the live show, jump onto your favorite podcasting platform and you'll find me on Tracy Tully Talks. We do have some adult language, so if you have some little ones around, pop on your earphones.
Hi, I'm Caroline Bellinger, life coach, gym owner, author and speaker, and creator of Be the Impossible Courses. I'm coming from Gold Coast in Australia. Unfortunately, Tracy couldn't make it right now. Hopefully, she might be able to jump on a bit later, but I'm going to do the Tracy Talks today. So to tell you a little bit about myself, who is Caroline Bellinger? So, you know, one of the things that I really am passionate about is my history of addiction and child sex abuse. So essentially, I grew up in a loving family, and I think that's where people often, you know, it's hard for people to understand that, you know, child abuse occurs throughout demographics. It's not just poor people. It's not just rich people. It occurs across the board. And even in Australia, a recent statistic of a 2017 survey said that 11% of women had been sexually abused before the age of 15. And these are frightening statistics. And for anyone who's, you know, listening in from Australia right now, you'll know recent news, there's a lot of stuff happening in our media, in our governments, of sexual abuse, bullying, harassment, and really that keeping women quiet. And for me growing up, you know, one of the most difficult things for me was to talk about my experience of child sex abuse. So essentially, like I said, I grew up in a beautiful family. You know, I have an amazing family who've always been very supportive of me. So when I was about 6 or 8, I then at a Christmas had, I was a bit of a, like, I was the youngest, so I was a little bit of a drama queen, admittedly, even back then. So I used to always have little tantrums, and as if anyone's the youngest of their family, they will know that you do tend to get teased probably the most. So I'd have a little tantrum, and I had this uncle come and find me and, you know, and make it all okay. So essentially from there, I started staying with my aunties and uncle, and the really, again, what we don't know, and as kids we don't know, all I knew was that I was getting all this amazing attention, and that's part of the grooming process. And if we're not talking to our kids now about this stuff, then, you know, they're going to think, hey, this is wonderful, because I did. As a child growing up, having this extra attention from this uncle made me feel special. You know, I probably never felt as good as my brother, who was incredibly smart. I never felt as attractive as my sister, you know, who always had boyfriends or boys wanting to date her and stuff like that. So, you know, I was always a little bit insecure. So in many ways that made me extremely vulnerable. And there was nothing out of the normal for, you know, all of us to go and stay with relatives. So, you know, there was nothing my parents would have known or even imagined. And this is, we're talking, you know, although I look, you know, 30, we're talking this happened back in, you know, the 1980s. And absolutely there was no media coverage about this, unless it was something, you know, really public at the time. We didn't talk about child sex abuse. So as the grooming kept going, what happened for me was I did start feeling uncomfortable. There would be situations where he would touch me inappropriately, even when my parents, and that would be in a different room. So although I knew that it was starting to feel uncomfortable, I never actually said anything to anyone because I also had been so groomed towards this attention that I didn't understand what, you know, that it was sexual advances. I didn't understand grooming. All I understood was I was the center of attention. And, you know, I was taken places. I was given presents. I was given money. So this started about 8. I went to university. I always wanted to be a vet, actually. I love animals. I still love animals, and I'm hoping that my little cat doesn't destroy my interview today because she is known to do that. But I've always had an affinity for animals. So I wanted to be a vet. Unfortunately, I just missed out by like one mark of getting into university to become a vet. So I then went to, my second choice was pharmacy. My dad was a pharmacist, and that's all I knew because I really, other than being a vet, that's what I'd wanted to be since I was like 3 years old. So I went to uni at age 16. So it was very young. And that's because we'd moved around a bit and I'd just started school young. But, you know, academically, you know, I had really good grades. I was pretty much a straight A student. So I got into pharmacy, and it was at that point that I met boys and I found alcohol. And by this stage, my uncle was still inappropriately touching me. And at university, this continued, but that's where it started intensifying. So I was just thrown into this environment. Alcohol gave me the confidence that I didn't have. And what I thought was it made me, the boys like me more. So I had my first sexual encounters at university. And as a child of sex abuse, you know, I thought that sex by this stage sort of equated to someone loving you. So unfortunately, you know, it was a pretty quick lesson that especially, you know, with 18, 19-year-old boys or 17-year-old boys that, you know, sex didn't mean love. And so I had a couple of experiences there. My uncle started visiting me, would visit me at the university, and he would bring me money. He would bring me food packages from my auntie, but he'd also bring me money. So this is where my guilt and my self-hatred started, because sometimes I would let him touch me just so I could get the money so I could go to the pub and have fun. And I knew by now that what was happening wasn't right. And he would, you know, he would come to my room, he would lock the door, he'd make me lie in the bed, and he would just touch my breasts and my chest and things like that. So I knew this wasn't right. I actually told a few of my friends. I also told the university, and it was just sort of shut down. But that is exactly what people did back then. And I don't blame anyone. You know, I don't blame anyone except for my uncle for what happened to me. And, you know, that's taken a long time to get to, and that's really important for me. So, again, that happened eventually in my state. I failed my first year at university, and that was a combination of, my uncle, alcohol, and, you know, just not putting myself into my work or anything like that. I came back, I repeated, and that's when my uncle tried to take it a step further and have me remove my pants. I knew that was wrong and I stopped it there. I then rang my parents and I said, oh, look, I'm failing. I'm not good enough. I need to leave uni. So I never, ever told anyone in my family what had happened, and I just went back home to live feeling like a failure. And from there, the next few years, like by this stage I was drinking a lot. You know, I was out. I ended up on the Gold Coast where I am now, but in the nightclub scene. So, I got a good job. And I just partied, I drank, I probably had my first experiences with drugs then as well, and, you know, a combination of that and, you know, a lot of sexual encounters. I was still so confused about sex and love. And also I had really bad, because my uncle had given me money, I had really bad mindset around money as well. Fast forward, you know, probably 10, 15 years, I lived in Melbourne. I lived on the Gold Coast. I lived in Byron Bay for a long time. I had great jobs. You know, I've been like, at 23, I was the assistant manager of a flight center in Byron Bay. But because of my drinking, because of my growing self-hatred, my lack of confidence in myself, you know, nothing would last long. And, you know, I started having more depression. I became suicidal. At 23, at a party at my parents' place, I was drunk, and things escalated, and there was like plenty of people there. And that was the first time I told my whole family about my experience of sexual abuse with my uncle. And do you know what? Like, they supported me, but they didn't want to talk about it. And, you know, they thought they were doing the right thing by not talking about it. But as we're learning now, and what I love about today's society is it is open. It is being discussed. We are talking about it. Because from that moment on, the guilt and shame I carried was like a weight around my neck with everything I did. I thought, essentially, everything that had happened to me was my fault, that somehow I had let it happen. I did my first stint in rehab when I was like 23. It was just 2 weeks. And, you know, I got a lot of, I did mostly a bit of therapy around the sexual abuse then. So I was sort of handling that a bit better. Yeah, like I said, the next few years I ended up overseas traveling. I ended up back in Melbourne, back in Byron Bay, back on the Gold Coast. I never stayed anywhere. I never had long-term relationships. I eventually went and lived in Thailand. And again, like, my life was, I had great jobs. I had great parties. I had great friends. But the intensity of my self-hatred and the intensity of my depression, my suicidal ideology, I had a couple of suicide attempts, just escalated all the time. At the same time, I relied on alcohol so much because I didn't know how else to cope. I had very poor emotional coping mechanisms. Fast forward to coming back from, I went to America. I thought that was the man I was going to marry. That didn't work out. And I ended up back in Australia. And that was in 2001. I then moved in with another guy. It was just all around drinking, really, at that stage. And just for me, it was just, I just drank to survive. My head drank to survive my emotions. I'd also been reasonably highly functional as well. So I guess that's where I sometimes think that my downfall took so long, because I was intelligent enough to hold jobs. You know, I was social enough to wear this mask when things were like falling apart on the inside, which, you know, again, like so many women and men, but, you know, so many women try and hold it together out to the world when their worlds are falling apart, because, you know, we've got to be the good mother, the good partner, the good daughter, all those things, the good employee. And, you know, there's all this responsibility of how we portray ourselves. Fast forward, I'd been home 5 months and I'd moved out from this guy. I got pregnant. I did a home pregnancy test, and that was, at the time, was the most devastating thing that could ever happen to me. I was 32. I'd never wanted children, not because I didn't want children, because I hated myself so much that I just didn't think any child deserved someone like me as their parent. So I went to an abortion clinic only to be told that I was 5 months pregnant. I was barely showing, you know. I remember being there in tears going, what does that mean? And the nurses there were amazing. They put me onto a doctor who they'd all used, who I went and saw. I then went, okay, I'm still not having this child. So I then started having counselling for adoption. So I was going down that track. I was still drinking, smoking. I wasn't taking drugs at that time. But, you know, I hadn't really – I'd slowed down my drinking and I obviously wasn't going to nightclubs and anything like that. But I was still drinking, you know, wine mostly every night and smoking. My doctor, you know, I told him that. And he like everyone was around me was really supportive. So when – my child was actually born. I remember even like when my waters broke, being by myself in my apartment going, oh, my God, what do I do? Because I hadn't done any preparation because I was in such denial. Fast forward to the hospital. My son was born in like about 6 hours. So I had I pretty much had a really good pregnancy, a really good birth, and I can't say what changed, but about 7 days after my son was born, that was the arrangement with the adoption agency that I would, you know, sign the paper and hand over my son. I remember just looking at him and thinking, oh my God, we're stuck together. And, you know, I still look at him and we sort of say, yeah, we're stuck together. So at that time I decided, yeah, obviously to keep my son. His name is Amadeus. And I wouldn't say I became maternal overnight. I don't know if I'm even maternal now. But I loved him. So I left my parents. My job had asked me if I would like a promotion. And I wanted that. So my parents said that they would help me raise my son, that they would look after him as a baby. So they were living in Queensland, I was in Melbourne. So I went back to Queensland with them. And the idea was to take a month off work, they would look after him, and I would go back to work until I was ready to balance both. A couple of months after being home with my parents, my dad got cancer. And so I never went back to Melbourne. My dad had cancer. I started drinking again because that's all I knew. I struggled, even though, like, my son was pretty much the perfect baby and slept right through, did all the right things. I struggled emotionally as a parent. I was resentful that I had no freedom left. And, you know, all that stuff from, you know, that childhood sex abuse of not being good enough, the shame, the guilt, I think, you know, and they say, like, having a child can trigger all that again. My dad passed away 10 months later, and that was probably one of the most difficult times of my life. I then moved out, supported by my mom, but we couldn't live together at the time. She was grieving, obviously. I was struggling. I was still drinking. I moved into another house of theirs and sort of raised my son the best I could. I then, when he was about five, I went back to TAFE and did an online IT course. I got the highest achievement online for the whole of TAFE in New South Wales. And that was drinking every day as well. You know, so I was still this functional person to everyone else. And I think that's one of the struggles, you know, was just keeping that mask on. Eventually I moved up to Queensland to work, and it wasn't long before everything just fell apart. I couldn't live with myself anymore. My suicidal ideology was terrible. My guilt with this beautiful child, who was seven, you know, seven, around seven at this time. You know, not remembering if I'd fed him, not remembering if we'd had dinner, not remembering going to bed. My blackouts were horrendous. I was drinking in the mornings. It wasn't good. At the same time, everyone who met me, saw me, thought, oh, Caroline's got it all together. She's got this perfect job, perfect life, perfect child, and just crumbling on the inside. Eventually, I did a six-month residential rehab program, and my mum looked after my son while I did that. And let me tell you, that was probably one of the most intense things I've ever done. We even had prisoners come in as part of a drug program through the prison. They would go back to jail because apparently it was easier than our rehab. But, Joe, the first couple of years, I've been sober now, I'm just coming up to 12 years. The first couple of years were just insane. When you get sober, and I think this is what everyone struggles with, and realistically, even going to AA, I think there's a 5 to 10% success rate for addiction. So I'm extraordinarily grateful today that I'm still sober. And what happened was, after I got out, I was struggling because I didn't know how to cope with emotions without alcohol. You know, I drank when I was happy, I drank when I was sad, I drank when I was angry. Now all of a sudden I was flooded with emotions. So, yeah, the first 2 years of sobriety was extraordinarily difficult, but much easier than any day I'd had sober. And, you know, and being able to have that time with my son and start building myself back up to a person who I believed in. And so that went on. I went back straight out of uni, straight out of rehab. They said, do not do anything, you know, too major. So I decided that going back to university at 41 was not too major. I ended up completing my degree in social science. I then went on to do honours study. Unfortunately, again, during that time, my brother got cancer and he had a very short time with cancer, and he passed away at 8 years ago now. So again, really difficult times, but by not drinking, oh my God, I can't even imagine how I would have survived any of that if I'd still been drinking. The reality is now I haven't given up drinking. I've actually started a life. I've gained so much more. And, you know, it concerns me in Australia especially. There's such a culture around drinking, and, you know, COVID is a prime example of drinking going up, gambling going up, bottle shops being essential services. And I'm sure just that whole pressure that people have, and alcohol so easily accessible. And, you know, in my mind, you know, even compared to all the other drugs, alcohol is by far the most destructive. It destroys families, you know, with domestic violence, car accidents, violence, random violence out on the streets, the king hit punches, all of that. And yet as a society, we accept alcohol for some reason as being okay. But, you know, that's a whole nother topic I could get onto. And for me, getting sober, what I started AA, I found it a bit depressing, to be honest. Like, I needed it to begin with, but I just found it very dogmatic, very depressing. And that's when I found running. So I'd always done sport, basketball, you know, a bit of running. I was never the runner in the family. But I found for my mental health, that running just changed the person I was. If I was cranky, upset or anything and go for a run, you know, by the third kilometer, it's just like, whoosh, everything just disappears. So running became my go-to. I was working in a university environment, worked at a surf club, then worked in a university environment, loved my job. But it became very toxic with bullying and harassment. Same with the Surf Life Saving as a volunteer. I went through some horrific experiences, bullying and harassment. I think, you know, in many ways, what's coming out at the moment, being a female, like if I'm too assertive, I'm bitchy. If I'm too emotional, I'm weak. And, you know, I can be a bit of both. I can be assertive and emotional. And I've learned to love those characteristics. I've learned to go, you know what, they're my strengths. I wear my heart on my sleeve and I don't apologize for that. I, you know, and without alcohol, I can be a little bit more controlled over it, although sometimes I'll just lose it. And that's okay because, you know, I speak up for who I am. I speak up for what's on my mind. I'm very passionate against bullying and harassment. And the starting to believe in myself and has just made me so congruent with who I am. And that leads me on to what I do now. So because of my fitness, I then decided I would open a gym. Go at 46, I did my personal training certificates, fitness certificates. I then also started triathlon, and just on the side, my son and I in 2019 went to Switzerland in Team Australia, so represented our country in age group triathlon. The year before that, we climbed to Everest Base Camp. And I'm a big believer in being active and taking action, because we can sit there and we can try and manifest everything, which is so important, but you've got to take action. So from my gym, I've sort of started more, I opened up a life coaching business. So I currently am in the process of getting all my life coaching business up and running. I'm also work as a business coach for another company, and I love that. And I think my best skill is getting people to believe in themselves, because for me, the turning point wasn't giving up alcohol. The turning point for me was believing in myself. Because I think it's really easy to get caught up in wanting other people to believe in us, you know, and we all fall a bit victim from needing validation from other people. And, you know, that's natural. We're human. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I love getting validation from people. We all do. But we can't rely on that to be the people we are. We have to believe in ourselves. And that comes from a lot of soul searching and a lot of humility. And with my life coaching, I'm about to release a program, a six-week program, you know, to help heal survivors of sexual child abuse, women. And why I'm so passionate about that is for many women, and like I said, statistically, that's 11% of Australian women who've experienced sexual child abuse. That's a lot of women. And we carry and have carried the guilt and the shame of all of that for far too long. And no human should carry guilt for something that happened to them as a child. So with my coaching, that's about teaching women that it's okay. It's okay to be you. It's okay to start believing in you. And, you know, it's not about ego, because I think believing in yourself requires an incredible amount of humility and self-awareness. And I think that's really important. You know, when I make mistakes. I make mistakes all the time. I say the wrong thing. I do the wrong thing. You know, none of us are perfect. And but as soon as I do that, I can self-reflect and go, fuck, I mucked that up. And if needs to be, I'm more than happy to apologize. There's other situations where I probably go, do you know what? I don't want that person or that situation in my world anyway, so I'm just going to let it slide. I think, interesting, my word for 2020 was T. Teflon, you know, like the Teflon saucepans and the Teflon fry pans. And like I said, when COVID hit everyone and life changed or didn't change, you know, for some people it didn't change as much. And that word Teflon just was perfect. But I have that same thing now when people talk about me. And because I can be outspoken now, yeah, I get people who don't necessarily like that or feel confronted by that. And that's okay. I'm not here to please everyone. And what's that saying? I love that saying. You're not pizza. You can't keep everyone happy. And that, I think we've all got to understand that. I think, again, my child abuse experience made me very much always be a people pleaser because I was always trying to make everyone else happy. And I've realized as I've got older that, you know, that was at the expense of my own integrity because I was doing things and not setting boundaries and, you know, having expectations that other people would do the same thing. And, you know, you can get let down a lot if you have expectations. And, you know, I'm not religious. I was brought up Catholic. And, you know, I probably stopped practicing Catholicism when I was about 18. And again, that's, you know, I'm happy to say that I'm a feminist. And in that context, I would say feminist means equality for men and for women. But, yeah, so the Catholic Church with their restrictions on contraception, sex before marriage, stuff like that, that was probably what turned me away from that. I probably more align myself with Buddhism, but sometimes I love the practice of non-attachment. And I think that's a really difficult one because, again, we're human and, you know, we have so many beliefs. But what I love about that connection as well is, so with my life coaching business, I also then went on to study NLP and to study hypnosis. And I love the way that can work on your subconscious because I've done counseling, I've done psychology, I've seen psychiatrists, I've seen drug and alcohol counselors, I've done a whole 6-month rehab program. And that's all good and you need that to process what's happened. But what I love with coaching and neuro-linguistic programming is working on how you can work towards a better future. Counseling doesn't always give you the skills to then cope with what's coming ahead or to plan what's coming ahead or to change beliefs around those limiting beliefs in your subconscious that you still hold on to because, you know, a lot of counseling is more, you know, your conscious mind and memory and things like that. So, yeah, that's what I'm passionate about, change. I'm passionate about not being stuck. And it doesn't matter. Like I'm now, I don't know how old am I? I'm coming up to 52 in a couple of weeks. And, you know, I'm the happiest, I'm the healthiest I've ever been. But if you look back on my history of drugs, alcohol, self-harm, you know, I'm extraordinarily grateful just to be alive. And that's why I don't even, you know, people will say, we have one drink. I go, yeah, no, because I wouldn't risk everything I have for what could happen. And like I said, now with the drinking thing, I really don't feel like I've given up anything. And it's probably only been in the last, like I said, coming up to 12 years, it's only been the last couple of years that I've actually felt like I'm not missing out. You know, and it doesn't help that everywhere you go, celebrations, you often, you know, there's champagne, there's alcohol to celebrate. And I'm okay with that. And I also get that, you know, for some people are okay having a couple of drinks. I'm not one of those people. I'm not one of those people who does probably anything by halves. So it's learning, you know, what works for you. And I think that's where I think coaching and what I do is so important because everyone has a different story. And on that topic, that's a nice segue into my last year I was also, during COVID, I was lucky enough to work with 15 women And we co-authored a book called Empowered Women Empowering the World. The thing I love the most about this book is there are 15 different stories of women who have overcome adversity and gone on to be successful. Now, successful, again, is a, you know, in context, is what you call successful. But they're all happy and successful. And they're all, every single story is different. Every single story has had a different challenge. And I think we have to understand that every person has a story. You may not think that your story is important, but I'm a strong believer that if your story connects with one person, if one person connects to what I say, then do you know what? I've done my job. I've added value to the world. And I think, you know, at the moment in the world, it can be pretty with COVID and politics and all that. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of hatred. There's a lot of judgment. But as individuals, we can impact that. It's like that little ripple effect. You know, you just drop one pebble and, you know, those ripples start going out. And if we're all just nicer and kinder to each other, you know, the world would be a better place. And I think you can do that better when you work on yourself. Because if you're comfortable with who you are, then you can accept other people for who they are as well. And by no means does that mean you have to accept bad behavior. You have to accept situations that don't serve you. I'm very good on the block and delete on social media. You know, if there's something coming into my world that is negative, first I'll analyze what is it about that and why am I triggered by it, and is it something I've got to work on, or is it just something that's just horrible and I don't want to have in my world? And I get to make that choice. And I guess what I want women to know and understand is it doesn't matter when you make these changes. Look at me. You know, it took me till I was 40 till I got sober. It took me until I was 50 to represent my country, climb Everest Base Camp, open a successful fitness business, write a book. I just want everyone to feel as happy as I do. Does that mean I have bad days? Yes, I absolutely have bad. And I still suffer, you know, from anxiety and depression. I've learned to manage them. I've learned to run when I need to. I've learned to go to bed and cry when I need to. And a lot of that comes to not judging myself either. I was just going to have a look at if there's anything, else to say about that. But I think, you know, and like I said, in Australia at the moment, there's a lot of coverage about the treatment of women. And, you know, I think there's a lot of discussion on why, you know, again, why women allow themselves to be treated like that. And, you know, that's an interesting thing to say, because I've had that said to me, you know, and, you know, I've done study in domestic violence and stuff like that. And you know, there's so many factors of why people stay in a situation that doesn't serve them. And, you know, if in many cases it's just they fear for their life of leaving that situation. You know, it's as simple as that sometimes. It's, you know, for women in jobs, they are stuck in this bind where if they say too much, they're not supported and then they don't get the career opportunities. And for many women like myself who've experienced child sex abuse, there is a belief deep down that this is what they deserve. And I think it's about being supportive so that women can understand that's not what they deserve. That's not what anyone deserves. As humans, we deserve to be treated with respect. Across the board, males, females, children, every race, every, you know, disability, we're ultimately at the core, we're all human. And as humans, I think the best thing we can do is be supportive and non-judgmental. And, you know, and if you're going to be judgmental or a situation doesn't align with you, you remove yourself from it. Rather than add fuel to the fire or, you know, make people have to convert to your view of the world, just accept that that's their view and their journey in life. But mostly, I think, focus on you. Focus on all the things you can do to change your world, because we do spend too much time trying to change other people. And as my, you know, I think the best thing when I was drinking too much and my son was younger, one of the best things my mother did at the time was not support me. And when I say that, she supported me with love, but she withdrew, picking the pieces up from me, enabling my behavior. So that put me at a crossroads where I had to make a decision about my life, you know, and it could have gone the wrong way. And, you know, I've lost over the years, I've had a lot of friends who've been in all, you know, different stages of recovery. I've lost friends to overdoses and other illnesses due to alcohol and drugs. And at the same time, do you know what? You can't be responsible for everyone else. You can only be responsible for yourself. And it's the same with your children. You know, ultimately, they've got a journey. They've got an experience in their life. And you can guide them and you can support them. But whatever happens for them is their journey. And I think if you can role model to them about being a good person, or, you know, having coping strategies around your own issues, working on your self-esteem. And that's what I love that. You know, I love the fact that the more you get to know yourself, the more you can behave in ways or react in ways that are more congruent with who you are, rather than just reacting to situations as well. So there's a question that Tracy was going to ask me was, what would you tell your 13-year-old self about what you know now? Do you know, my 13-year-old self, yeah, I probably would have said, it's okay to be you. It's okay to just be who you are. You don't, you know, a 13-year-old for, you know, teenager and a girl, you, and it's worse now, like with social media pressures and all that stuff. You know, it's okay just to do you. And I think that's, you know, there's so many sides. In some ways our society is so much better because we are more tolerant, and I think that younger generation are more tolerant. But then on the other side, we've got all this expectation and pressure from social media. And, yes, some pretty horrible bullying. And I think it's just harder now because, you know, a lot of 13-year-old kids can't escape it when they go home because it's on their phones. It's on their, you know, Instagram accounts, their TikTok. So I still think even with bullying, and like I said, my own experiences in the workplace, I think if you can build a strong, resilient child, then that's how they'll cope with life's obstacles, because life's life and we're all going to be thrown amazingly challenging situations and people. And it's about working on yourself so that you can face those issues and be true to yourself as well. And another question I think Tracy was going to ask me was a fun fact about myself. Okay, well, I've got lots of fun facts. I sometimes think I'm a child at heart. You know, one of the best things about getting sober was I found this like childlike feeling that I think I lost as a child of sexual abuse. I think I had so much responsibility within me, so much seriousness about all that I've had this newfound love of life. And I, again, you know, from like suicide attempts and things like that, like I'm so grateful for everything I have. My son, we often say, oh, my God. I go, oh, my God, who's the adult? And they go, oh, that's right, it's me. So fun facts, I love chocolate. I love eating chocolate for breakfast, even though I run a gym. I'm very anti the fitness industry and diets and any type of extreme restrictive type of activities. You know, be sustainable, be balanced. And if you want to have chocolate for breakfast, I'm telling you that's okay. You know, life's a balance or a blend of everything. And, you know, the kinder we are to ourselves, the easier things blend together. And like I said, none of us are perfect, and that's probably the beauty of life. We're not supposed to be perfect. So, yeah, my 13-year-old self, I would have said, just be you. You don't have to be perfect, and that's okay. And, you know, stand up for what you believe in. And I think that's really important. And, you know, what I want to teach in my coaching. And you can find out more on my coaching on my website, www.carolinebellinger.com, or my Facebook or Instagram pages, Caroline Bellinger Official. And just start believing in you. Do whatever it takes to work on yourself. Make that a priority in your life, because we often put everything else as a priority and we don't work on our own health. We don't work on our own well-being. We don't work on all the things that are so important. You know, I have so many people, you know, and I do a bit of business coaching as well. And, you know, I love the company I coach for because it's about holistic, because there's no point being wealthy and stressed and then having a heart attack. There's no point having, you know, 1 million followers on Facebook if you're not happy. Like, we need to get out of this whole sphere of doing things for other people or doing things for appearances and connect with our own true selves. And, you know, part of that too is connecting with, for me, it's about connecting with other women and men. But, like, obviously my programs are mostly based around women, but I also think that, you know, when it comes to domestic violence, child sex abuse and things like that, you know, some of that is stuff that only men can solve. And, but, yeah, I love working with women and I love working in the mental health field. I love just being able to teach people to believe in themselves, because I think ultimately when I look back at all of my transformation, the most amazing thing I think is when I started believing in myself. The thing that changed everything was when I started believing in myself. And now I actually don't need anyone else to believe in me. They do, because I believe in myself, but I don't need that. So, yeah, I think next on the journey for me, like, and that's it, I'm always like, well, what's next? You know, I want to write my own biography and tell my story, and I want to speak more about child sex abuse, because it's a topic that has been taboo for way too long. It's a topic that impacts so many lives, and you know, it wasn't just my life that was impacted. It impacted my aunties, my family, my parents, my friends. And we need to be able to support each other around this, and we need to be able to talk about it to do that. There's no point. One thing, one of my pet hates in the world is people who try and shove things under the carpet. You know, and I'm dealing with a few of those situations at the moment where it's like, you know, if we don't address it and we just sort of make excuses for it, then like we can all move on and be happy. And life doesn't work about that. Things always come back. If you don't, and, you know, that's even on yourself. You know, you can think, I even now sometimes think, oh, I'm on top of everything. And then, you know, I might have a bad day. And those little demons from 30 years ago just pop their ugly little head up. And if I wasn't self-aware enough to know that, you know, I could spiral out of control so easily. But, you know, I'm lucky. I'm so eternally grateful. And I think that's the other thing, you know, something that's extraordinarily important to me. And I think that comes a little bit from a lot of the stuff I did maybe with Buddhism, but also just in life probably, and in rehab. I started this in rehab. So one of my chores or jobs in rehab was to write down 3 gratitudes every single morning. And I now, I live in gratitude. So I don't actually have to write them down anymore, but, you know, I could be like in my kitchen and just look out the window and go, oh, my God, I'm so grateful for where I live. Or, you know, put on my favorite pair of shoes and think, oh, my God, I love these shoes. I'm so grateful I can have them. You know, at the moment with COVID, even though, like, you know what, my business shut down, I live on a state border which had a, like, border crossing. So I didn't even go to the state I technically live in for, like, 4 months because it was just too hard. But I go, oh, my God, but I'm grateful for where I live because there's so many other places in the world that are worse off. So I call it living in gratitude. It's not about being grateful anymore for me. It's about living gratitude in everything I do. And that's why even, you know, when I still have bad situations happen, you know, if you've got enough gratitude, you know, they say you can't live in fear and gratitude at the same time. So, yeah, practicing gratitude is an incredible skill to have. And I think sometimes with all of this, it's about not overcomplicating life. And just it's the simple things. Like for me, you know, the best thing I can do when I'm feeling a bit down or depressed is go for a run. I also, you know, if I feel like I want to kill someone, I'm so cranky. You know, it's amazing. Just a run will fix that. Or sometimes like going out in nature, being outside. I'm extraordinarily grateful and lucky I live near the beach. And when I was being bullied in my workplace, I started a little practice where I would go to the beach every single morning, you know, 15, 20 minutes just to refresh and reset so I could tackle the day. So it's about having time out, space for yourself, especially like busy mums, you know, you need that time out. So like I always say to my clients, it's not selfish to put yourself first, because if you can do all the things and look after your own well-being as a priority, you're a better mum, you're a better employee, you're a better daughter, you're a better friend, you're a better partner. And I think we need to start looking at self-development along those lines, that everything else is better when we are better. So thank you, everyone, for today. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to maybe meeting you all one day or chatting. And, yeah, so again, if you want to find me on social, it's Caroline Ballinger Official on Instagram, Facebook. Also Epic Pro Fitness is my other account. And you can also see my website, www.carolinebellinger.com, or email at media@carolinebellinger.com. And it's been a lovely day, and I'm sorry that Tracy wasn't here to join us, but we wish her well as well. And I'm sure I'll be catching up with Tracy at a conference on Sunday, an online conference. So I'm sure if you go to Tracy's page as well and on my page, you can get the details of that International Women's Conference that's held this Sunday. So, yeah, make sure you check that out as well. And, yes, thank you for listening, and I hope to, you know, engage with you all at a future time. Go out there, believe in yourself, and as I like to say with my courses, be the impossible, because you can and you deserve it. So take care, everyone, and thank you.
Thanks for listening to another 60 minutes of inspiring talking points on Tracy Tully Talks, brought to you by bbsradio.com. Tune in every Thursday morning at 10 a.m. Australian time, AEST, and 5 p.m. PT time in America. Leave me a message on my website at www.bbsradio.com/TracyTullyTalks. If you're interested in lifting the profile, presence and profit of your business, sponsorship opportunities are available. Until next Thursday, it's goodbye from me.